Gavin Woods Podcast, proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Chris Tahini from Geisha, and you are listening to Gavin Woods Podcast.
I'm very excited to speak to my next guest on the Gavin Wood Countdown Podcast, none other than the lead singer of Geisha. Remember Geisha in the 80s? They were huge. The lead singer of Geisha, Chris Tahini, is on the line. Hi, Chris.
Gavin. Oh, mate, so good to talk to you. It's been so many years. Actually, you know what? I don't know if you remember this. The last time I saw you, we were in the car park at a community radio station chatting, and you were telling me you were heading off to the States. It was, I can't remember what it was, but Mark Kopeloff.
2007.
Yes, that's right. I was with my good friend Michael Matthews, and
that's
we saw
right.
you. And
that's right. Michael. Dear Michael.
Yes.
I got there a month before the global financial meltdown. That was fun. Enough of me. What about you, Chris Tahini? What's been happening?
Where shall I start?
Let's go back to the start. How did you know that you wanted to be a singer in a band and be a star?
Well, it's an interesting question. I didn't even know I could sing when I was 13. I was a classically trained pianist, and my family are all classically trained, various instruments, strings and woodwinds. Mm-hmm. So for 10 years I studied piano, and that's what I did. But then I wanted to meet girls, and my best mate at school, a boy named Jim Lowe, said, you know what, they're doing guitar lessons. And I said, mate, I already know how to play a bit of guitar. And he goes, yeah, but you'll meet girls. So we went down to the guitar school. It was Bob Pett's Oak Park Guitar School, because right. I grew up in Broadmeadows. And he said, well, come down. It's like $2.50 a lesson, Chris. Come on, we'll meet a girl. So I ended up going down there and sort of busking through the lessons, because, you know, I was already playing a little bit of guitar.
Right.
But then I sort of grew attracted to Bob Pett's daughter, who was taking the money at the door.
Right.
And ended up taking her out. So I still didn't know I could sing yet. So as we started forming a band, everyone was going, well, who's going to sing? And I said, why don't you sing, Jim? Oh, you can sing monkey songs pretty well. And he said, I'd get too nervous. And I said, all right, I'll do it. And it went from there.
Right.
So, you know, in the early 80s, I had many bands, from the Officials to Deadline to all sorts of things. And then I grew a bit annoyed with the music industry. It was really hard to get a footing.
Yeah.
So I thought, because I was also, at the time, I was also at a school, chemistry. I was a chemistry major, and decided to work in a laboratory. And so I said, you know what, bugger it. And I moved to Adelaide for a year.
Right.
And then I got a bunch of calls from various agents and managers that I'd known saying, come back, we'll make it right, we'll do it properly. And that's how Geisha Detail started. They put together a band for me, people I didn't know.
Yeah.
Ken Shepherd on guitar, who I liked a lot, and Ian Bull on drums, and the bass player from Paul Kelly's and the Dots, Paul Kelly and the Dots, and a keyboard player named John Nyman, who ended up being in the band, of course, same as Ken. Yeah. So we worked it out, and it was Geisha Detail at that time.
How did you come up with that name?
Well, it was interesting. Well, see, Japan was all the flavour in Australia at the time. I think INXS had a video that was very Japanesey, you know.
The Vapors were turning Japanese.
And the Vapors, that's right, exactly. And Sui and the Banshees had a bit of a Japanese flavour to them. And, of course, there was Japan, right?
Yes, of course.
The English band with David Sylvian and my old mate Rob Dean, but that's another story. Mm. And then so we put the band together. It sort of formulated. I decided I didn't really grow up with these guys, so I needed someone close to me in the band. So I trained my younger brother. He's 6 years younger, and I was only 22, 23 at the time.
Mm.
He was only 16, 17. And I trained him to play bass and brought him into the band, and he became a heartthrob. The girls loved him, and put the band together. So after much negotiation and Michael Matthews coming down to Melbourne to the Green Store Tavern every week to see us.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers offered us a deal, but EMI offered us a deal as well.
Right.
We ended up going with EMI because I quite liked the rapport with Michael. And also Peter Dawkins was head of the company, and I liked Peter Dawkins' production.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
Ah, absolutely. So as soon as we just before the ink was dry on the contract, we got a letter like a solicitor's letter saying that the previous members had registered the name Keisha Teetsail.
Oh, no.
And they wanted $30,000 to release it.
Of course.
And I said, $30,000? Are you kidding me? You know, I'm on the dole.
Yeah. Funny.
So we had a big meeting. I had a big meeting with Zeb Isaac. And he said, just change the name. And I said, well, it has to be similar because we started to build up a rapport with the Melbourne collective, you know. So I just said, drop the detail and call it Geisha.
Which is the best thing you could have ever done because it's a great name.
And the rest is history. Mm. We recorded our first single with Dave Marrant from New Zealand, who had been doing Little Heroes.
Was that Fool's Way?
That was Fool's Way. And it was amazing. It was an amazing thing because we got Carl Steinberg from ABC to produce the video, and he's the video.
He's a very tall man, Carl Steinberg.
He is a very tall man, and I'm not a very tall man. So when we got together, it was like chalk and cheese. But he was lovely, you know.
Yeah, he's a great
excellent
guy.
Man. Mm. He is a great guy. Well, you know him, of course.
Oh, very well. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Carl, we met lots, and we went to parties together, and he got a vibe on me, and he came up with this idea. He wanted to shoot the clip in the Melbourne University underground car park, which, of course, was used in Mad Max.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's got those arched supports for the ceiling, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a wonderful. It was the most amazing experience of my life at that time, being like 23.
Right.
And there was a massive production, you know, lighting and camera work and, you know, all the techs people.
This was an ABC clip, right?
No, this was a EMI sanctioned clip. It cost $25,000.
Right, but I was going to say. Yeah.
$25,000, but we hired Carl to direct it.
Fantastic. Carl was doing a little bit of moonlighting on the side.
Well, it's interesting because I don't think it went well for him. He did our first two clips, and I think he left the ABC after that.
Oh dear!
But see, I married an ABC producer, so that sort of went on for a few years.
It's all intertwined.
It is. Oh, it's what a wicked web of, you know.
You weave.
That's right. Yes, my first wife was Roz Stock, who worked in radio and then moved to television.
Yeah, I remember the name. Yeah.
Yep, yep. And she ended up working on Spicks and Specks as an assistant producer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, we did our first clip, and the rest was history. You know, I woke up one morning at my apartment in Richmond, and it was on the radio.
And how fun would that have been? What did you jump on the bed like a 14-year-old and run around the room?
Like
Tom Cruise.
That's right. No, but I was, you know, euphoric. I've got to say, it was very nice indeed.
Oh, what a vibe, mate! To be lying in bed and then hear yourself on the radio. Oh, that's really cool.
Look, I grew up listening to 3XY. Mm. I mean, Eon FM was a relatively new thing.
Yeah.
And with Lee Simon. But, of course, I grew up watching Lee Simon on Nightmares.
Yeah, of course.
And Lee was integral in Eon. So it was fantastic, you know. Oh, wow, I've made it. Yeah. Wow. Well, not really, but to a 23-year-old, that's kind of making it.
So was that Fool's Way or was it Part Time Love Affair that you heard on the radio?
Oh, no, that was Fool's Way, the first one in 1985. I think we released it in February or March, 85.
Okay.
You know, God bless EMI. They got it on radio virtually straight away, especially in Melbourne and Adelaide. Adelaide picked up on it really quickly. Well, we had a huge following in Adelaide.
Michael Matthews was very proactive in that area.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know Michael well.
I would say Michael Matthews would have been one of the best A&R guys in the country at the time.
Absolutely. I would agree with that 100%. I learned all my tricks from him.
Is he still wearing that bloody hat?
Yes.
Good on him. That's nice. Hello, Michael. I know you're listening and I love you. Now, let's get into the second single. Was that Rainy Day?
Second single was Rainy Day, and we also used Carl Steinberg to make the clip. Uh-huh. By this time, the first single was produced by Dave Marrant from New Zealand, who'd done The Little Heroes. So by this time, I'd travelled to Sydney and met with Peter Dawkins. Now, Peter Dawkins wasn't supposed to be producing us because he was CEO of EMI at the time.
Yeah.
Right, so you know, like there was a conflict of interest, but he said, look, I'll do it anyway. So he decided to produce our album. So we basically started work on an album up in Castlereagh Street, in 301 Castlereagh Street.
The Geisha album.
The Geisha album, the first one. Mm. And it was the best experience of my life, Gavin. Mm. It was just amazing, you know, to have basically EMI looking after everything, you know, in an amazing studio. The SSL desk and system had just been installed.
Oh, it would have blown your mind.
Oh, it really did. I'd done a lot of recording before, but I've never seen anything like the new digital SSL in 85. Mm. It wasn't even truly digital, but it was still going to analog tape, but nonetheless.
Yeah.
And to put cream on top of everything, used Richard Lush as our engineer.
Dear Richard, who worked at Abbey Road Studios with the Beatles.
That's exactly right. So I was absolutely beside myself because I'm a massive Beatles fan.
Mm.
So Richard was there, and Richard was literally reading the manual on how to operate.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, how fabulous.
Because they were brand new. Nobody knew how to operate them. And so we spent 6 weeks in Sydney, holed up at the Bondi, the Cosmopolitan.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives since 1934. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Chris Tahini from Geisha, and you are listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Let's get back to Geisha, because you created a really big impact, because back then there was Kids in the Kitchen, Geisha, Real Life, and it all seemed, it was like, you know how the English had Duran Duran and Simple Minds and all of that. Well, we had our own little party down here.
The Melbourne explosion of rock music and pop music was quite amazing. I mean,
how
I guess
fun was it?
A few years earlier. Oh, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess Men at Work. I mean, well, going back, you could go back through any decade, but Melbourne's always been a centre of cultural interest, you know. I mean, I've always thought we've had the best music come out of Melbourne.
Oh, we have, undoubtedly.
So Rainy Day, it went really well in Melbourne. Once again, we always had a problem with Sydney catching on, but, you know, Adelaide, Queensland, all did really well. Didn't do as well as Fool's Way, so we let it go, and then we released the next track, which was Kabuki.
Kabuki, yes, right.
And we were travelling back. The record company had flown us in the middle of making an album. They'd flown us to Adelaide because the record company had heard that the Fool's Way was still exploding there. So they booked two gigs at a place called La Rox, and they flew us down there and sent our roadies over by road, and we did two nights at La Rox, and the place was packed. It was like, and I guess it would have been in those days, maybe a 600-seater.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
And it was jam-packed, so we did these two gigs, but then they sent us, we didn't fly back. They put us in a Tarago, and because it was the weekend, so we were driving back to Melbourne. As we were coming into Melbourne, we heard on, I don't know whether it was 3XY or Eon FM, I can't remember, but they were saying, and the number one top 8 at 8 is Kabuki.
Fantastic.
And we were going, this is great. This is great.
We've made it.
We've made it. Still $150 a week, but we've made it.
So tell me about the eventual demise of Geisha and what happened.
I'll tell you what happened. The reason there was a dissension is because I was writing all the songs.
There you go. Bit of jealousy. Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, they wanted a piece of the pie. And that's okay. I understand.
Hmm.
That's just what happens. And in excess, we're able to sort of change that by just giving everyone an equal piece of the pie. But I didn't, because I was advised by Sev Isaac, as we discussed earlier.
Yeah,
you know,
Write
your songs. Write your songs
and own them.
Put a date stamp on it, and you know that's yours.
Yeah.
Publish it, and so I said, okay, no. These are my songs, and so the only way they were going to get a piece is if they wrote with me.
Yeah.
But that caused dissension. So little by little, band members left,
mm-hmm.
and by other people, unfortunately, much to the there were a lot of fans that didn't like that, but I guess you know that's. Like with Colin Hay, that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, of course. Now, was Midnight to Dawn, that album, was that happening around that time when the band members were leaving?
Yes. Well, interestingly enough, we just changed members from the five-piece into a three-piece. We brought on a new drummer, And Ken and I were basically running it. And the record company put us into the studio with this producer that nobody had heard of, but apparently he was supposed to be something. And it was a waste of time. But really, he was from England and he was just a coffee boy. So we wasted thousands of dollars with him. And then they were a bit, you know, reticent to let us do anything more. We said, come on, come on, come on, please let us do it. And they said, no, no, no. So Barry Chapman, my publisher, said, I'll put the money up, all right? And because I think, you know, this might be all right. So Barry Chapman put the money up and he said, but you need to work with this producer. And we said, okay, no worries. And we did. It was Spencer Lee.
How did he work for you?
Well, here's how it went. He did all the work. He basically got in this guy who ran a Fairlight computer and basically reconstructed the whole track. And then we went and Ken did guitar solos and I did vocals.
And that was it?
Pretty much. And that's why Part-Time Love Affair sounds the way it does.
Right.
I mean, we produced the original version. And in fact, Eddie Rayner
from Split Ends
Yes, he played the intro.
Okay. So the band broke up in, what, 88, around 1988?
Well, yeah, pretty much. But, Ken left and the drummer left, and that was Brett Luton. And then I called up some friends in the UK that I knew, a guy named Tom Hosey, who used to play with James Freud and the Radio Stars.
Yeah, okay.
I said, look, I've got to promote this album, because we'd made this album, Midnight to Dawn, and I said, I need a new band. And he said, oh, okay, well, have you got a guitar player? And I said, no, Ken's left. And he said, well, I know a guy who really wants to visit Australia.
Okay.
I said, well, who is it? And he goes, well, it's Rob Dean from Japan.
Oh.
I said, oh. I said, okay.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But you need to sponsor him because he needs a working visa to do it.
Of course.
Said, yep, no problems. So Rob Dean came out. He was an interesting character. And Tom's been a long friend of mine for decades. So then we needed a keyboard player. So I spoke to Laurie Maddy, who was the keyboard player from a Melbourne band called No Nonsense, and who'd played some keys on the Midnight to Dawn album, and he joined us up with us, and we were a four-piece. I decided to pick up the bass, and which had been one of my early instruments anyway, so it wasn't a big deal. And that became the last lineup of Geisha. And then we went into receivership, basically, because it was a company, because by the end of 88, we were in debt over $200,000 because it was the crash. Remember the crash of the late 80s?
Oh, yes, yes. Big one.
And that was the end of Geisha for the 80s.
Gee. Now, just quickly, what was the inspiration for the name of Midnight to Dawn?
Because that's our job. We're out Midnight to Dawn as a band,
Okay.
Especially back in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was it. That's where we spend all our time. And, you know, the old, the belief that, rock musicians, they sleep until midday.
Yeah, they're at Pellegrini's till 3 o'clock in the
Pellegrini's.
morning.
I love their spaghetti bolognese.
It's the best, isn't it?
It is the best. It's the best in Melbourne.
Now, tell me, you had another version of Geisha back, well, in 2007. Did you try and get the old band back together, did you?
I did. Well, once again, Michael Matthews and I sat down and said, look, you know what? That first album's never been on CD. Why don't we put a very best of Geisha album together?
Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And you won't believe how much trouble it was, let me tell you. EMI had lost all the master tracks.
Oh, no.
Well, they moved from Castle Ray Street to Silverwater or Homebush or whatever.
But that's a sin. That's a sin for a record company to lose master tracks. How dare they? That's
correct.
Terrible.
They actually didn't lose them. They knew exactly where they were. They were on a pallet in the car park in the rain.
Oh, God.
Which is ironic because I wrote Rainy Day.
Yeah. So they would have sounded good, not?
Well, we couldn't use them. So I went back to my old mate, David Briggs from Little River Band.
Oh, lonesome loser, David Briggs.
That's right. And he said, well, what have you got? What source material have you got? And I said, well, I've only got the original vinyl album. He said, all right, let's bring it up. And he brought up the vinyl album. And with the software he had, he was able to get all the glitches out.
All the stems. Did he get all the stems out, did he?
Yes. Well, he stemmed it. He, transformed the analog into digital. Gee. And then he got all the pops and crackles out, and it was painstaking because this is 1997. You know, the software's a little bit different now, but he did a great job.
God, love
him. And we were able to yes I do love him, he's a great man. And so we got the very best of Geisha. But then Michael says, well, why don't we do a gig and to promote it? So we put the band back together, rehearsed it for a week, brought everyone down, accommodated everyone, and spoke to Frank at Premier about putting us in the Mercury Lounge. You remember the Mercury Lounge?
Yes, oh, very well.
Yes. So the place was jam-packed. I've got video of it. It was amazing.
I remember
all
that.
The old fans came out. We played all the old hits and some more, and it was a terrific night. Brian Cannon came down, and we had a big chat. And after the show, and the show went well, and it was great. So we were a bit of a joke band to start with. We thought, oh, I can't be bothered carrying around all these amplifiers and electric guitars. So we took out, we said, get a guy to set up a PA, and we're just going to bring acoustic guitars. And we played this gig at the Turf Club in Caulfield, and it went off. And we're going, what's going on here? This is about 1990.
Right.
So I think we just fitted in with what was happening in general with the, you know, the vibe.
You read the market.
Oh, well, only by accident, Gavin, only by accident.
Oh, that's good.
And then the band started getting booked at all these places, and we had a standing booking at the Cherry Tree in the famous Cherry Tree in Richmond, and the South Euro Saloon Bar, of course, on a Thursday night for 5 years, and then I said, mate, because Pierre from Pierre Gigliotti was in it.
Good bass player.
We had great bass player and a good singer. Excellent. His harmonies are perfect, and we had the drummer from Divinals, who's recently passed away, and this fella named Sean. Who hadn't really done anything, but he was a very creative fellow.
Right, okay.
I said, why don't we write some songs, real original songs, and put out an album, which we did. So my old friend Craig Harneth from Kids in the Kitchen, who at that time owned a studio and still does, called Hot House in St Kilda, said, okay, come in, you know, I'll give you a special deal. So we recorded and paid for our own album.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Chris Tahini from Geisha, and you are listening to Gavin Wood's podcast.
Tell me about More Than a Game, because I just love that song. Now, did you release that song before, or did you do it for the footy show?
Well, here's the thing. There was a fellow named Harvey Silver, who was actually Harvey Silverstein. His brother, Salek, submitted some propositions for video clips for Geisha.
Yeah.
So I knew him. And then Harvey used to come and see Geisha, great guy. And he used to bring his friend Darren Saniki. And one day when we were, all the young dudes were playing at the South Yarra Saloon Bar, maybe 1993, he said, Chris, I've got an idea for you. I said, what is it, mate? And he said, Channel 9, we want to do a pilot for Channel 9. I said, okay. He goes, it's going to be about footy. And I said, yeah. And but see, I don't follow footy, Gavin. It's never been my thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, it's going to be footy on Channel 9. But I knew enough to say, well, Channel 9 doesn't have the rights to live football, so you're not going to be able to show any live footy. Mm. He goes, I know that. So we're going to have this guy named Eddie McGuire, who's a journalist, and Sam and Trevor Marmalade. And I said, Trevor Marmalade, he comes down to our gigs all the time at the Carousel in Albert Park.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, what do you want me to do? He goes, I want you to be involved in the theme. I said, oh, okay. Can you meet me at Elstonwick at this studio? And I said, yeah, sure. He said, we need a bit of help with writing it and, you know, putting it together, and I want you to sing it. And I said, sure. How much does it pay?
I think I'm going to throw up here pretty soon. go on, keep going.
So I went down there and we started putting the song together, and they said, we still haven't got a melody for the chorus. And Josh Abrams, who's quite a well-known producer now, was actually doing the engineering and producing of the demo. And we got it together, and Harvey kept saying, no, I want you to sing it like you used to sing in the mid-'80s in Geisha, like that. Mm. And I said, okay, how's this? Understand, there's a fire that burns brightly inside you. He goes, that's perfect. I want it like that. Mm. And then we worked on the chorus and stuff, and finally we had a product. And so they took it back to Channel 9. They put the show together, the pilot, and I went on my merry way. I didn't think much about it.
Mm.
And then they came back to me and said, Chris, guess what? I said, what? Channel 9 want to do a year. They want a 12-month contract. We're going to do the show. I said, what? I said, yeah. So that means we have to record it properly.
Right.
So I said, okay. So they booked us into Sing Sing. Yeah. I think it was called Sing Sing then in Richmond.
Yeah.
So we did it properly. And then my wife rings me up and says, you have to look after our daughter today. Because we'd split up at that time.
Right.
So, but I'm doing a I'm in the studio. She goes, nope, you have to look after her. So I took my daughter, oldest daughter Ella, into the studio, and she was misbehaving because I was in the voice booth and she was outside.
Mm.
And I said, look, bring her in, and I'm sure she'll be very good. So she sat behind me in the voice booth on a little table with plasticine or Play-Doh, mm. and she was quiet as a mouse for the 2 or 3 hours that it took me to get all the vocals and harmonies done.
Oh, isn't she sweet?
Yeah, she was beautiful. She was like 2 years old.
Yeah.
And then I said to Harvey, look, mate, I'm not really into football and I've got this other band, Dragonfly. Do you mind not giving me a credit on the show?
Mm. Oh, Chris.
I know.
Zev Isaac would have turned around 10 times and fallen over.
I know. So all of a sudden, within 6 months, the show was rating through the roof.
Mm.
And so Harvey calls me up and he says, can you come and do it live on the show? And I said, sure. So we did a live vocal version of it on the show, and Red Simons pretended to play the guitar solo and duck walked across the stage.
Mm.
I thought, oh, wow, this is interesting. And then I got a call from Harvey again. He said, mate, they want you to do it on Hey Hey, It's Saturday. I said, oh, okay, all right. So I went on Hey Hey, It's Saturday and I did it. And then I started realising that it was going through the roof. So I rang Harvey. I said, Harvey, listen, mate. Look, I know I said I didn't want a credit on the show.
Now but, I do.
Yes, that's right. Do you mind if I have a credit on the show? And he did. And then the next 27 years sort of, you know, it paid for my first wife's house and, you know, worked out well.
I was going to throw up because I thought you were going to tell me that you walked away with nothing. You had no points.
No.
You had no points and you had nothing, you know, nothing.
Oh, no.
Oh, good.
No, mate, honestly, I made more money out of More Than a Game than I've made out of, well, nearly everything else. I made a lot of money out of Darryl Braithwaite and Lee Kernaghan writing songs for them. But More Than a Game...
I'm so happy to hear that because it's so good when you hear good stories that people did get paid what they should have got paid in the music industry.
Absolutely. No. It was all great. And interestingly, after 27 years, I actually know quite a lot about football now.
I'm sure you do. But, but you know, that's just one of those magical things where, you know, as you go through all your whole life, you'll be singing that song because that's one of the babies, you know, that you gave birth to and grew into this amazing thing. Everybody remembers it.
That's exactly right. Now, Gavin, do you remember doing an interview with me and my band, All the Young Dudes, for Greg Petherick? Do you remember that?
Where do we do it? Remind me.
We did it in the studio.
It was out of Channel 10, was it?
Could have been, or it could have been down in Port Melbourne where we were shooting it.
All right.
And there was a making of clip made by Greg, and I think you were doing all the questioning.
Right.
I'll send you the link, and you can have a look. Oh. It was good. It was great.
Well, that's all right then. That's okay. All right. Well, look, let's move on. Thank you for doing this podcast, and thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it, Chris. But we end the podcast with our top 10 countdown questions. So
excellent.
So I haven't pre-prepared you or anything like this. This is straight cold questions. So here we go.
Okay.
Question number 10, who inspired you to make music? I think we know. It was your friend at school.
Well, yes, kind of, but it was the Beatles, really.
Okay. Right. Well, weren't they brilliant? Because when we started, the Beatles started, basically, when you think about it.
Yes.
They'd only been around for a couple of years and blew our heads off. Yeah.
Oh, mate.
Question number 9. What have you learnt over your musical journey?
To be kind.
Lovely. And you are. Question number 8. What was the effect of Countdown to your career?
Massive. Back in the day, there was nothing more important than getting your appearance on Countdown. It made the difference between success and failure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Question number 7. If you could open up a show for any artist, who would it be?
Cheap Trick.
Oh, yeah. I saw them at the Palace.
I was there.
And he was throwing his picks out into the crowd.
Oh. Well, see, I don't know if you've ever seen me flick my picks, but I learned that from that guy.
Nielsen. His last name is Nielsen.
Yeah, Rick Nielsen.
Yeah, what a great band.
So and I saw that and I thought, what a great idea.
Question 6. Name your 3 dinner guests, dead or alive.
Oh, that's a good one. Okay. Howard Hughes.
Wow, yes.
Paul McCartney.
Mm, lovely.
And Nikola Tesla.
Oh, yes. Up to 11. Now, what is your favourite song to perform?
It's More Than a Game.
More Than a Game.
Do you want me to sing it? It's More Than a Game.
That's it. No prompting from the peanut gallery. Sorry about that. What is the most trouble you've ever gotten into? Christo Heaney from Geisha?
Let me see. Gee whiz. No, I'd never get into trouble, Gavin.
Oh, please, spare me. You and Michael Matthews, you must have been arrested at least once.
Nothing I can tell you on the radio.
Okay.
So, no.
All right. I'll let you off. Question number 3. If you could change anything about the
Gavin
music
Woods.
Industry, what would you do?
That's also a really good question, Gav. I don't think it's possible to change it, but if it was, I would regulate the internet far more than it is at the moment because musicians and writers are losing money hand over fist. I mean, we used to sell records and make money, and now it's streaming. We get 0.001 cent for a track.
Apple and Spotify have stolen your art.
Pretty much. But, you know, I love Spotify too. I can't be hypocritical. I use it to listen to music. So
if they just gave you a bigger cut of the profit, that would be nice.
I think, yes. I think writers need to get more from the streaming services, absolutely.
Yeah. Question number 2, what's the best show that you've ever done?
Best show I've ever done was with the Thompson Twins at Thurbaden Theatre in Adelaide.
Oh, yeah.
It was 85. It's a funny story. Because I had the big bright red hair with the, you know, the mullet and the sticking up hair.
Yeah, yeah.
We did a few supports with Thompson Twins. We rocked up in our Turaga and the teenagers ran over to us and they're going, and
Thompson
then they realized that's exactly right. They thought I was him.
Yeah.
And they walked away disappointed. But after we'd done our set, I was standing up at the back of Thurbaden Theatre and they were fantastic.
They were absolutely
brilliant. That was a great show.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it was all generated by Fairlight, but the staging and the props, brilliant.
Final question. Christo Heaney from Geisha and More Than a Game. Question number 1, what have you learnt and what would you pass on to a young hopeful musician?
I would say become a lawyer.
Yes, make some money.
Also, once again, just be kind every day. Be kind to everyone.
Yeah, that's a good thing to live by. Well, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I have had a blast and I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast has had a big smile on their face all the way through, mate. So continued success with Geisha and all the different incarnations and have fun with Absolutely 80s. I'm sure everyone's going to get out there and see you.
Thank you so much, Gavin.
Gavin Woods' podcast was thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.